I think like one of my favorite questions comes from Brené Brown in the one-on-ones, and I'll give you some of the tools that I've learned. I study a lot, but her question is, what does support from me look like for you? You'll be shocked at the answers. And it's one of the most powerful, like I remember driving down the road. I was actually on like some side road up by these farmer's fields, driving up to see a friend and listening to this podcast, and pull the car over and stop as I'm making notes. But what does support for me look like for you?
Welcome to the Proven Principles Podcast, the show that deconstructs the inner workings of the hospitality industry, breaking down the tools, tips, and tricks that the world's best run hotels use every day. Here's your host, Adam Knight.
Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. Before we get going on this episode, if you find this show and content provides value to you, I'd really appreciate it if you took a few seconds to leave a rating and a review on your podcast app. And if you're not a subscriber to the podcast, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Both really do help the show get found by new listeners, and we're all about getting more people in on the conversations we're having here. So with that, my guest today is Matt Rolfe. He's the founder of Results Hospitality and West Shore Hospitality Group. He's also the author of You Can't Do It Alone, a new book about achieving more through building better teams. There's been a lot of news about labor shortages at the hotel and restaurant industries as of late, and frankly, a lot of blame as well. Candidates don't show up for interviews, or HR ghosted me, or they're just chasing another dollar at the restaurant down the street, or we don't have a budget to do it, are all common talking points today. Well, we try to address and get around these barriers in this episode. And the common theme that we keep coming back to is coaching and people development. But the conversation goes beyond the typical talking points that you hear about when taking care of your people. We try to come at it based on the current employment and business environment, what's driving unionization efforts today, and what some of the more innovative companies in hospitality are doing right now. Matt shares stories that drive the points home, and he does a great job of outlining some of the steps that you can take today to make a difference in your organization. So let's get to it. This is episode 94 of the Proven Principles Podcast, Matt Rolfe on what it takes to build world-class teams. Enjoy. Hey, Matt, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Adam. I'm thrilled to be here today.
I want to dive into this book so bad, but I'm going to hold back for a second.
Sure.
Because I just want you to kind of give the audience a little bit of color on who you are, what you're up to.
Awesome. Well, I've spent my entire career in hospitality from just entering at a leaving high school. I kind of found hospitality by mistake as in high school. I was diagnosed with a learning disability and was actually told that I wouldn't graduate school. I was told to go find alternative employment. So I kind of fell into hospitality, that industry, with open arms, and took me for who I was and invested in me. And going into college, worked in the industry, and then had the opportunity to work for Bacardi and then Labatt, which is owned by Anheuser-Busch. And through that process, was exposed to hundreds of operators and really fell in love with the operation side. And over now, it's almost approaching 15 years. I've been an entrepreneur. I don't believe I'm that old, but I am. So for 15 years, I've worked exclusively coaching restaurant leaders and leadership teams. First, we were trying to make them more profitable. So for the first 5 years, and I still have a company that does that. But now I'm really focused on the people side of the business. You know, how do we invest in ourselves and our people to get the results we want and deserve for our restaurant? Mm-hmm. Or a restaurant group.
How did you get into that people development side of things? Because I think, you know, as an entrepreneur / consultant myself for a little while, that coaching piece, and we'll get into this. I really want to get your thoughts on this. But that coaching piece from your perspective, did you go into it, take any courses? Did you get any certifications? How did you finally like get the skills to do it? It wasn't just self-taught.
And that's it's a great question. And I looked around. I had a passion for personal development. With my learning disability, I never read a book till I was 25. And somebody handed me a copy of Think and Grow Rich at 25. Hmm. And I'd open books, start them, have some tapes in the car because I like doing sales back in the day. But I really took this passion for self-development and made a bunch of investment, which was one of my vision board and my dream with Tony Robbins. Mm-hmm. Then I was part of an organization called Entrepreneurs Organization and got exposure to my first coach, which we worked on for retreats. And then I hired him one-on-one. He's really one of the top coaches who supports entrepreneurs. And he just really allowed me to filter my own content. Mm-hmm. So rather than go, and he pushed me based on my personality not to go get the certification because he was worried that I would just take somebody else's program and scale it. He said, I need you to make your own. So it made it a little bit harder initially to frame, but I was lucky to have relationships where I said, trust me, let me do the work. You're going to get all of me and my team. I'll give you everything I got. And luckily enough, people did. And we've got a pretty significant coaching business, definitely the largest one in Canada and wow. scaling in the US as well. So yeah, it was a process, right? Just like anything else, we had to test the waters and prove our way and get testimonials mm-hmm. and
figure out what works.
It's been a fun journey.
Yeah. There's probably little, at least in the US, I'm assuming in Canada is similar. There's little more in the news that is not, you know, this is an economy question, I guess, that's going on as so much as obviously the Great Resignation. I'm going to put air quotes around that, a little tired of using the term, yep. but the big change in work culture, hospitality is not immune. It's probably leading the charge in some of those changes, or maybe leading the charge and trying to hold on and keep things the way that they've always been and refusing to move the needle in a meaningful way, with the exception of probably a handful of really great companies, which we can dive into. I want to get your hot take right now. Where, like, from your perspective, what's going on in the hospitality industry, and where are we at as we're coming out of this pandemic?
Yeah. So when it goes back to the, you know, again, air quotes around the Great Resignation, that, you know, what my experience, I was seeing 100 to 120% annual staff turnover prior to the pandemic. And what I share with a lot of people is COVID didn't create necessarily, or the pandemic create new issues, but it definitely magnified them. And what we're seeing now in full service restaurants is over 200% annual staff turnover, and quick service going kind of 300-400%. I know Starbucks has shared some results of 400% annual hourly staff turnover for sure. So, you know, we have an issue. And I think we're with seasonality right now, especially in North America, with summer months coming up in the back house, we have a major issue. But my take on it was broken before. So what we were compensating people for in the conditions, the communication and the development, there were gaps. And now what's happening is the candidate has the leverage. There's less of them than there are positions. I did a restaurant show last week where Technomic shared 17% of hospitality jobs are open. And that was a sobering stat, because I think in the US, they're saying it's about 8-9% of overall jobs are open.
Yeah.
So you got to think all the US, all North America put together, 17 jobs are open. But what we're working with our clients on is, if you're approaching attraction and recruitment and retention of our people the same way we did pre-pandemic, you're going to struggle. And yeah. I would say that more aggressively if it was appropriate, but I care about people listening to this. We need to approach attracting and retaining in a different way. And that starts off far upstream as our job ads, where we post, more importantly, how we filter, how we compensate, recognize, and reward. So I know there's a lot in that. But I think really, if we just sit down and somebody look at who are your top five competitors, what are they doing? Are we aware? What are they compensating? What are they offering? You know, what are the non-comp perks for the job? And then I would look at who's your audience and what do they want? You know, one thing, I worked with somebody last week who's going very heavy on time off. Hmm. They're up to 7 weeks. Which to me, I was like, okay, like that's a no joke, you know, competitive point of difference. And they're balancing, because if they don't, they're going to create the turnover anyway. So I think, how do you be unique, exciting, and how do you attract somebody? But you've got to interrupt the pattern.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And all I see is job postings with, you know, $1,000 signing bonuses, $5,000 signing bonuses. But we're all talking about there needs to be a change in this. Well, a lot of us that are a little bit on the outside looking in, maybe not, you know, sitting in an office at a big corporate restaurant or hotel company where, you know, you're sort of butting up against old ways of thinking and old policies and all that, you know, legacy employee, like all that, how you manage that. It's people outside looking in going, look, we all recognize that there needs to be a change, but we haven't yet really seen anybody take the bull by the horns and be like, you know, with the exception of, you know, the 7 week thing, it's signing bonuses and everyone's just trying to throw another dollar or two an hour at the problem. Right. And it's obviously not working.
Yeah. And the concern there, because once we give comp, and this is old research we've always worked with our clients on, is what people want is they need their base financial needs met. And the Gallup organization does the largest employment survey. I think they do it every 2 or 3 years, 8 million people across 8 business sectors. And the results have been the same since I started following the survey. When somebody's base financial needs are met, what they want is the ability to learn and grow in their role. Mm-hmm. And that's like, so I can pay my rent, go out for dinner once a week, do this, my car payment, my my TTC pass, what it's called here, mm-hmm. transit pass is covered. And then I want to grow in my role. So the assumption might be comp, but I really want people to be curious a little bit longer and talk to their people. Like, what do they want? I made assumptions, you know, with our team, our team still wanted remote opportunity. Our team wanted, there needed to be some financial base corrections, but we also wanted experiences where we're investing significantly in people's development. You know, we're in this game too. We're not hiring dishwashers, but our other company does inventory for a living, third-party inventory for restaurants. We're getting people to count inventory all day, every day. So we needed to stand out to get to attract people. And the good news is our staffing rosters are full. And we're recruiting again. It's just, but we take a fundamentally different approach from others.
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point, because once you hook the employee with the candidate, potential employee with the job ad, and they're in the interview process, there's ghosting and HR has fallen off. You know that I don't know if that's the case anymore. It was earlier on. What has to happen from your perspective in that interview process to get the person who's being interviewed great, I'm here. Now tell me all the great things that you're going to do for me in this company, because it really is a two-way kind of symbiotic relationship. You know where I'm going with this question, I think.
Well, I think like on this side, my experience, and I say this a little bit more direct and we can expand on it, but it's not about you. Like that side, it's not about me, the employer. It's not about you, the employer. It's about the candidate. And what I'm always focused on is who's the audience? What do they want and need? How do I appeal to them? Like, it's still, we all know we need to change, but most interviews, people are looking at somebody, say, tell me why I should hire you. And the whole process is broken. Or people, I would really encourage you, based on ghosting, if you're still doing one-to-one interviews, the amount of wasted leadership time, we did this with a client at the start of the year, they were wasting about 7 weeks a year of managers waiting for people to show up to interviews that weren't going to show. So how do we move to an interactive interview that's about them? In our, for our business, anybody who comes to the interview gets a $20 Visa gift card. Just show up. And this is for part-time inventory, the other side of the other company. But we're trying to, again, interrupt that pattern. Just show up. No questions asked. You can walk out the door if you want. We'll give you the gift card.
Yeah.
But we're trying to have an attract strategy. And then in that interview, I want them to we have to identify what do they want. And we had a breakthrough with a client last week. So they were hiring everybody the same way. We want 30-hour-a-week cooks. I'm like, but nobody can live off 30 hours a week. So they have to get a complementing job. So we have now have two opportunities. We have a 45-hour-a-week opportunity, and we have a one shift, a three shift opportunity. What do you want? Because for a lot of people in the back of house, the job that they're interviewing for, if you're looking at hourly, especially back of house gaps, is you might be complementing one or two other jobs they already have. But that's the perspective, right? When we went out and talked to them, what do they want? Flexibility, or we need more security in hours, or we need to make sure that I'm not going to be taken advantage of during the summer months based on being 20% short in the back. But I think that curious, that just if we talk to them, they'll share with us in your market what they want and need. And it's going to create a conversation that's different from people telling them what you're going to give them.
It seems to me that you got to have, as a hiring manager or department head who's interviewing and doing this recruiting, who's really responsible for heading up this recruiting or on the, you know, not posting the jobs, but, you know, curating and managing the applicants. Yep. They've got to have the freedom to be able to be fluid with the situation. They can't, so it's all well and good. And I completely agree with you to talk to people. You have to do that to learn what they want. The hiring manager can't be running up against company policies that prevent them from being able to do things that make sense.
Yeah.
And I totally get both sides of that conversation, because you can't have a whole bunch of new recruits that just have a whole bunch of different benefits and ways of working.
Sure.
It's just a nightmare to manage. But the other side of that is, like, if you're just trying to slot a square into a round or a square peg into a round hole, you're never going to move the needle.
Yeah. And I think there's patterns, right? So I agree with you. We don't want outliers. So we're creating custom, you know, job offers for, you know, back house employees, front house, management, leadership, whichever it is. But there are patterns of what your core, you know, employee avatar, your target wants and is looking for. So I think if we can really identify that and follow through to create consistency, we can create some good results. But last week I had a 2-day retreat, and they have to hire, they're in the campus university space, a really large university, and they have to hire 120 people because they've been closed for 2 years, 120 people going into the new year. And they had a candidate they love, but they said, well, we can't, you know, move them along the interview process. We have to wait for more options. But I feel this is the right candidate. This person was really excited, but we were stuck in old thinking that we have to move slow. We have to do this touch process. You have to see them. And it's no, we had a conversation, said, do we like them? We're not hiring them. Move them to stage two faster. So they have a 4-touch process we put in place, 4 interactions with the candidate. But rather than let that take 2 or 3 weeks where we'll lose that person from a management placement position, we want to go through those 4 touch points in 4 days. So I think those are the little changes, right? But it was the old belief system, the resistance that crept in. And it did take about a half an hour to work through this conversation, but we've always done it this way.
Yeah,
I really appreciate how we've done it. We just need to look at is how we recruited and hired in the past. Will that still work today? Elements definitely will, but we might have to tweak areas of speed, conversation, value, you know, offer to them and make it a little bit faster based on the job market.
Yeah. The speed conversation, I've personally lost candidates because we moved too slow.
Me too.
It's a big thing. And this is pre-pandemic times. You know, when we couldn't find anybody in 2017, 2018, 2019 to work in San Francisco in particular. It was impossible to fill jobs. If you wanted a job in hospitality in San Francisco, you could get one back then. You could get one now, but like it was just really hard to find people. But the thing that we ran up against a lot of the time with the speed was these colloquial way of saying it, these personality tests, these, you know, the hiring, the standardized interview that a lot of companies have in place. In the hotel space, that's pretty common. And I'm wondering, and I'm sure in the restaurant space, that's big. I'm wondering, and I'm just curious to get you, and I don't know the answer to this, if there's value in continuing to have those, or if you think about those things in the larger context of how they fit in, you're trying to build a team of like-minded individuals. You're trying to make sure that the patterns of thinking and the ways of looking at the world are a good fit for the job that they're applying for. There's a lot of reasons to use them. But if you're trying to speed up the process and you need to move quick, that could be a big barrier. And it just occurred to me as we're talking here that I wonder if those still have value.
And I look at kind of at two parts. So I think for some operators, hotel, especially with seasonality or full restaurant operators, whether you're an independent or national chain, I would break it into a couple different parts, or at least to who do we need right now? So we might have to get off script for 30 days to make sure that we have the staff in place to satisfy our guests and to not reduce our operating hours. Because those are real conversations I'm hearing daily now. It's a lot of great restaurant groups are closed Mondays. They're closed certain evenings because they want to balance their staff. So what's our blitz strategy that's going to go in place for the next 30 days? And then what's that more standard process when we get back to it, hopefully? And we don't know. You know, if you would have asked me 6 months ago, do you think that the shortage will get better? And I would have said yes. And it's not. It's actually increasing. So I put something out on social the other day and said I was wrong. You know, I think everybody thought, like, where did everybody go? Mm-hmm. You know, that's part of the question. And you know, where are they right now? And are they all working in the gig economy or changes or this or that? But hopefully we get a bit of a rebound. If we can break it into two parts, see what's next.
Yeah, it is a big puzzle right now. I think that's a question everybody's asking. Where did they go? Some changed, I'm sure. I mean, I did. I went full head first into entrepreneurship and, you know, that's it. Yeah. Not going back unless this fails spectacularly. I don't have any intentions to. Yeah, which hopefully it doesn't.
Which
it going on, I've heard so many people go on to other industries. You know, I was a cook for however many years, or I was a housekeeper for so long, and I found a call center job where I get to work from home. And I get paid the same amount, but I don't have to go in and like kill myself every day in this job. I get to be at home with family and, you know, plus on top of that, I saved hours commuting. You don't have to worry about that anymore. It's tough. Yeah. I had a conversation with someone not long ago about the real need to get serious about recruiting at not the college level, the high school level.
Yeah.
And kind of growing your own tomatoes, as it were, and getting in and doing, you know, work experience with high school students. There's a program that I know of down in Orange County, California, Dana Point, that is, it's a, I'm not going to explain this very well, but it's basically like a hospitality career program, part of the curriculum that was developed for this high school, where there is a little bit of work co-op kind of work stuff that's going on, but also there's theory and textbooks, and people from different hotels in the area go in and do lectures for the high school students to get them interested so that they know that this is a viable career option. And like that's the kind of stuff I think that we really need to, this is probably a problem that isn't going to be solved anytime soon. We got to put the steps in now for 2, 3, 5 years from now.
Yeah. And we're funny you say that, because we're just engaging with one of the restaurant associations here who's got a large government grant that's all focused and even starting in the public school system. So we've got, we'll all be going into the school system in the fall, doing multiple talks. We'll actually be bringing students out to tour some of these beautiful hotel properties. So Marriott's involved, Fairmont up here owned by Accor is involved. Mm-hmm. The senior regional vice president of Accor is going to be there on the kind of the speaking tour. But we're saying, how do we show them that, you know, the interest and the creativity and how to get in a back of house or understand the front of house, but also look at this as a career, not as a job that I do while I'm looking to move on to something else, which is something our industry struggled with for years. So we're just mapping this out, and I'm a spoke in a big wheel that the Restaurant Association is doing, but I'm excited. You know, my want based on my school experience is to go and give back. And I think that we can create interest and excitement and hopefully create a better pipeline of future leaders for our industry.
This, I know we're, what are we, 20 minutes in now? And I haven't even asked you about the book.
No.
But this is, You Can't Do It Alone, the book that you wrote. First of all, I commend you on being able to turn this around during the pandemic, because it's, you wrote it and released it, within the 2 years that we've been living in this world. How did this book come together? What was the inspiration?
Yeah, somebody who's not, my teachers would laugh, say spelling and writing is not my strength.
Well, that's talking, why there's editors. Talking,
yeah. But really what happened was I've been coaching for almost a decade and seeing common patterns with top performing leaders. And our team just talked to say, how do we share the message? Because we can't work with everybody. And it really wasn't, we never looked to approach a book to sell, a bunch of copies of the book. It's how can we help the industry? If we continue to give away as much value as we can, it'll help and our business will grow. And reached out to a publisher that was able to support me in the design of the book. And we just said, I said, do we think we have something here? And we mapped it out in a couple of days and they said, yeah. And there's huge interest here. We wrote the first copy of the manuscript. It was terrible. We did it all over again because it was mid-pandemic. There were so many changes. Rewrote the entire manuscript and we shared it. And the response has been, overwhelming based on how much exposure and people that are call and message and got the book and supplier partners. And I think it's not based on the book. It's based on people's want to absorb content, to do something different, to get different results. So it just, I think there's timing. I think a lot of books are really about timing, and this is one of many, but whatever helps somebody create the change that they want to need from themselves.
Yeah.
That was the want, and I've over-delivered significantly on our expectations.
I think it's, what I like so much about it is that obviously you've got, there's a lot of personal narrative written throughout, and you tie it back to your own experiences, but also, it's the way that it's laid out and the steps to create a high performing team are not, it's digestible. What I like is it is presented in a way that is like, I had a few kind of blinding flashes of the obvious through it. Somebody finally said the thing that I'd been thinking, but I wasn't really able to put the words to it. Yeah. And there's a section in the book that you talk about coaching, and in particular, paying more attention to the high performers in your organization than the low performers. And that is so, yes, obvious. Of course, you should do that. But literally nobody does that.
Yeah.
It's counterintuitive. Can you talk a little bit about that in particular? Because I want to unpack that piece. What is it that if you're leading a team, and you've got, or individual, you don't have to, like you've just got individuals that perform high and low.
Yeah.
What's your, maybe just walk through that. What's the perspective? How should you be approaching this in real time?
Yeah. So I think like what we look at, so if we look at a sports team, and it's a little bit sensitive for here up in Toronto, as we record this, the Leafs just lost in Game 7 of the playoffs. But if we look at a sports team, Auston Matthews would probably have a dozen coaches behind him. from nutrition to taking care of his body to his mental health to his mental preparedness for the games. And then you have average players, and then you might have some people coming up. But if we look at a sports model or a celebrity entrepreneur model, like how many coaches and support and boards does an Elon Musk have around him? You know, by choice. And then we get into the restaurant operation. And what I'm really trying to protect with this concept first and foremost, if you're a restaurant leader or manager out there, and just by environment, the most of our attention is going into solving problems all day, every day, and problems that are issues, the strain on the leader, just the mindset, focus, energy, mental health, you know, going in and we're solving problems or addressing issues. Where our focus, you know, Tony Robbins says where focus goes, energy flows. And I'm a big Tony Robbins fan. So I know it's a bit of a cheesy saying, but it's true. What we're giving attention will take over our focus and our energy. But if we shift to, if we look at where we're allocating our time of coaching, support, or course correction, it's often into the bottom 20% of our workforce, of our teams. But if we do focus on the top 20% or make sure they get the attention that they deserve, it's about most teams I get a chance to work with, there's way more working for them than not. But if we don't create an environment where they can recognize that, we'll focus on, you know, the 200 covers we did tonight and the five we messed up. So what I want is for your top performing leaders, especially in this great resignation era, if you want them to stay, we need to recognize, celebrate, and reward them consistently and relentlessly. And the best thing about positive recognition is it's free and it can have the biggest impact on your P&L possibly of anything you're going to do this year. They say it takes 1 to 10 times the annual salary to replace somebody. So it's going to cost you 1 to 10 times of their 50K or 100K package, depending on position. So investing in this area and retaining people 3 months, 12 months, 24 months longer has an incredible impact on the scalability of the operation and the culture within it. Just, and the question here, we want curiosity questions. Where is your attention going if you're listening to this? Where, and just break down your conversations in the last week on the back of a napkin. And you have a choice. You can shift that.
It's more than just about attaboys though, right? It's, you know, the, and I think the development piece is a really important component here that needs to be slotted in where, and I've been guilty of this. You've got high performing leaders or high performing employees who don't seemingly need much development. Your natural tendency is to go to the place where there's a problem and fix the problem at the root, which is, you know, we all know that. Meanwhile, to the whole point of this conversation, the high-performing people get forgotten about, and they get the odd attaboy, but that's it. There's rarely a conversation about how do we take this great person and make them even better, or how do we turn their focus maybe towards something that they're interested in learning a little bit more about. It's oftentimes that high-performing person has to drive that conversation themselves. It's rare that somebody in the organization will voluntarily come to them and say, hey, what do you, you're great, but how do you be greater? how do you be better? What do you want to do?
And I think like one of my favorite questions comes from Brené Brown and in the one-on-ones, and I'll give you some of the tools that I've learned. I study a lot, but her question is, what does support from me look like for you? You'll be shocked at the answers. And it's one of the most powerful, like it, I remember driving down the road, I was actually on like some side road up by these farmers fields driving up to see a friend and listening to this podcast and pull the car over and stop as I'm making notes. But what does support for me look like for you? And the other thing, if anybody's looking, if they have that feeling, like, I don't know, you know, they're doing great. You know, they don't ask for much, but how do I position a conversation with them, a coaching one-on-one or a develop meeting? And Michael Bungay Stainer wrote the book, The Coaching Habit. He has in that, in the book, he goes through these 7 questions. So it's a 7-question one-on-one that's really about the candidate that allows them to open up and show you what support looks like. And you can get the 7, I can send them to anybody, or you can get them on Google Images, just put coaching habit 7 questions. But they're the most brilliant 7 questions in a one-on-one process. Because what we just, I think what people, your high performers want, they might not want your management tactics. They might not necessarily need your direction, but I can promise you what they want is connection and your time. We do hundreds of discovery meetings with managers a year from the projects that we start. And always what comes back is, I wish we could have a conversation that wasn't just about ops. And that's my, I just want to sit across from someone, a team, or one across and say, let's have a conversation about us. How do you create human to human connection? And coaching is the one, I mean, in my experience, the best way to do that, but we just have to slow down just a bit.
They want to be seen.
Seen.
But how do you get better coaches? Is that, that's also part of the issue here, right? And the follow-up section in that book about creating a coaching strategy and whatnot, that's, I think that that's such an important and often missed part of the process here is, and I could tell you, I mean, you know, working with a couple of international hotel companies through my career, got to very senior levels, with the exception of like a handful of days in a corporate sponsored development training program.
So it's paying the bill, yeah.
20 years and I got a handful of days. The rest of it was trial and error. And, you know, and seeking out my own, like who do I appreciate that's just out there as a great leader? And, you know, Tony Robbins comes up and
sure.
Steve Jobs, you know, sometimes came up periodically, or other yeah. people, but it was self-directed.
Yeah. And I think that's when we look to somebody who gets to your level, right? So you have people will, your top performers. And what we talk about is strengthening the core, you know, the middle 60% of your leadership team or the people that are at a certain stage where that, and we do want to invest in the top 20%, but we want to move everybody forward. If we can move the middle up, the bottom 20, you know, probably over time, if they're not performing, it's better for you and for them. And I'm not a headcount coach, but I think that how do we focus and bring forward the top six or the middle 60% and support our top 20? Because coaching is necessary. And it's an opportunity to think, do we have a coaching culture or not? There's no right answer. But if I sat in a boardroom, you know, with a major hotel group and said, what's going to separate us from our competitors? What's going to create a point of difference where people want to stay with us or are attracted to work for our cultures? And often that development key, that coaching, we're going to commit to support you. We're going to commit bi-weekly. Don't overcommit monthly one-on-ones. If you can do weekly, great. But just in support of you and your development, it changes the conversation. So before where it was a choice, should I or should I not do development workshops? Or should I not do invest more time in teaching my people how to coach? That was a choice. And the challenge for me, let's say respectfully, it's not much of a choice and it's not a should do, it's a must do. And I'm not saying all your people have to be coaches or you have to hire a coach, but you have to approach the development of your people in a different way. And I say have to, I want it for you because the benefit, the clients I get to work for to see how quickly a culture can change and the results and the service and the retention change, it's through conversation.
Yeah, yeah. And those one-on-ones shouldn't just be a 30-minute set-aside meeting where the manager just tells the employee all the things that, yeah. like basically 30 minutes of running through a task list
yeah.
of
yeah.
things you didn't do well, things you should do next time, and all the things that I need you to do until the next time that we meet. Yeah. I remember seeing, and I put this into practice, a one-on-one format where the first 10 minutes was for me, the second 10 minutes was for the employee, and the last 10 minutes was run over time. Because sure. 10 minutes was never enough to cover everything. And once I got into that kind of a cadence, it completely changed they made the relationship stronger because there was time dedicated that we both knew where I wasn't, as the manager, I'm not talking, I'm listening.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like I look at this because I had an aha moment about 8 years ago. We got a chance to do some work with Starbucks Canada and with the president. So it's a bunch of one-on-one time with the president here. And he opened up 400 stores in his time in that role. And the funny thing, and there's a pattern of this when you look to great retail brands, and we are retailers in the hospitality industry, whether we look at ourselves that way or not. But the amount of time he spent 4 days a week in his stores, 1 day a week, you know, meetings and ops, 4 days a week in his stores, working with the leaders and moving through the different provinces or countries, because he did some stuff south of the US in development as well. But there was this commitment to coaching and support and conversation. But the challenge is in the average operation is we're too busy. Yeah. Or I'm not really sure if it's showing value. But look at any major brand, look at Walmart, right? It's the same Sam Walton story, whether you like the brand or not. It's the same, their leadership team having a significant amount of time in the store, seeing what's happening at the grassroots level. And I find so many of us are stuck behind email or in a boardroom or in our closed door offices. And I say that to be dramatic for effect. How do we go back to what matters most right now? It's our people. Your locations are probably sound. Hopefully you've got your menu pricing right. We cannot operate full hours without having engaged and inspired people. Mm-hmm. So what do we do to change that? How do we share our vision? How do we share what we want, our service strategy, you know, our people strategy? And it's going to be through one-to-one interactions, whether you want to call them coaching or not, which I think it is. the more time you spend with your people, the better results you'll see.
Yeah. And you're probably going to learn something along the way.
Yeah. That you didn't. Every time I sit with somebody. Yeah. I point this way because our office, we got a loft here and the office is downstairs. Every time I sit with these young leaders that are pushing my companies forward, I learn something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I say young because they tell me I'm old all the time, but they can hear this. I'm learning something every time. I think I learn more from them than they learn from me.
For sure. Yeah, I got to ask, in the context of this conversation now, we've seen some news stories recently down here, big unionization pushes. And the hospitality industry is not immune to that. It's a big unionized industry for forever. Do you think that the current, how much of the current environment is... And this may be not a fair question, but I got to ask.
Sure. Yep.
How much of the current environment, the politics of the current environment are, do you think, maybe causing people to look for outside representation between themselves and their manager? Mm-hmm. And is it because the pendulum's gone too far and everything that we're talking about has not been a priority in the organizations that are suffering from this right now? Or is this just, have we just completely broken the mold so much that people are really looking for some stability and this may be an avenue that they can find that?
Yeah, I think, there's a couple parts to that. So for me, the pandemic broke a lot of people's trust with our industry, meaning that they loved it. You know, we closed, we opened, we closed, we opened, we communicated, we didn't. There was unclear path forward or an unclear recovery. So I think what people want most as we dig into, the research, people want to feel safe in their employment. And we weren't necessarily the safest industry. And the media definitely wasn't representing us as safe, as we were continually told about unsafe work conditions and closing the restaurant industry, although we could go to the shopping mall and go to retail, especially up here in Canada and across the US as well. Mm-hmm. So I think there's that side. Is how do we make people trust us again and feel safe again? And I think that needs to be part of the conversation. On the union side, we, especially the hotel space, we hear some great things and we work with some racetracks and casinos. Union relationships are good. I have a couple of clients right now where the union is, they're the ones pursuing these environments right now because they, it's a good time to strike and grow their base. I would never talk poorly about, there's some great unions, but there's some ones right now that are causing some noise that actually hurt the employees.
Yeah.
Did not help. The pitch looked good on paper, but what's happening now in the infighting and the money and lawyers and the no moving, is it's actually going to create the inability for a couple of my clients to rehire certain people. And it's sad. Yeah. And it's not about, this isn't a paintbrush thing, but great unions. We've got some ones that are making top 50 employer lists here in Canada. Mm-hmm. And we've got some other ones that are just messing with a really good thing based on union dues. And I'm sad for the employees inside those environments.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast. We could
I
would love to dive into that. I feel like that along with some other conversations that I've had on the show are, you could inadvertently step on landmines, but I think it's just because people's belief system in unions, I think, are very strong.
And I think both of our feedback that I'll say, because that might have triggered some people, especially in the hotel space listening to this, is I care about I spend my entire life investing in the people of our industry, and all I care is they get treated fairly from both sides.
Yeah.
It's not about unions. It's about what's right for the employee base. And if there are situations where people were expected to overwork hours for, non-fair comp, and that needs to be corrected. So it's more, I think the conversation is, whatever the vehicle is, I had somebody call me and say, my labor is up 8%. What do I do? And I can't pay more. I can't. I said, yes, we can. We have to find the path forward. What's the top line growth we need to achieve to support our people in the way they need to be supported?
Yeah.
Not just signing bonuses, which, are short-term.
Right.
What's the long-term play? Not saying you shouldn't do signing bonuses, but what's your long-term comp strategy? And what numbers do we need to achieve to make that number make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And, I do get that conversation. I've had many of them over the years where you get blinded by the budget and you tie your own hands to the budget, thinking that this is something that can't be changed. Meanwhile, it was a document that you wrote in September of the previous year, and it's now August of the next year. And you're like, well, I can't do it because the budget says I can't do it. It's ridiculous. Of course you can do it. You just have to be willing to to make the right case to the right people who need to hear it, to give, you know, if you need some permission, or I don't know. That's a really big part of this conversation. And I think as we're talking about this, I think it's what I like about this conversation is that we're starting to kind of glom on some of the classic arguments as to why this stuff won't work.
What budget, are the objections?
Budget is a huge one.
Yep. And for the work that I do, I like the budget side. So if you're fighting for labor, you know, nobody goes in and has budget for a coach. They might have a budget for a consultant, but a coach. So we deal with that all the time where we have to show value. And on the labor side is one thing that I feel confident saying is we can't cut our way out of this in most cases based on inflation. So we can't just reduce costs or squeeze and be more efficient. We want to look to be more efficient, but the path out of this is returning to health. And if we don't have staff to leverage our core operating hours, mm-hmm. and not just people there, but people that believe in our quality in the kitchen, people that believe in delivering the experience that we've designed that allows us to stand out versus our competitors for our concept. Mm-hmm. If we don't have that, then we're going to end up looking at costs and it's just it's a revolving door. And it's not that easy. We got to look at it and be respectful. I'm a for-profit company, so we need to be profitable.
Yep.
We can't give away all the money and the business ends up running at a loss, but we have to, one of my companies, for the next 4 months, we're going to make remaining comp decisions that are going to run us at a loss for the next 4 months because it allows us the capacity to scale the back quarter of the year with intention and set us up for a great 2023 because we need to adjust and we actually need to bring more labor in now before it's needed based on the training path. So that's a decision. My partner has struggled with that, but I told him we have another recap on it tomorrow, but we're all in. How do you go all in to do right by your people?
Yeah. We talked about something interesting in our pre-call a little while back about Starbucks investment in their retention efforts. $1 billion, I think you said that they're putting in. Joey's Restaurant Group is another one that came up in our conversation that's doing some great things around this. Before we wrap the show here, could you just maybe give a little bit of color? I'm sure I'm not giving enough attention to this, but we're running almost 40 minutes now. Just give a little color on what you're seeing some of the great organizations are doing. Who are the ones leading the charge?
Yeah, and I think if you look at Starbucks, and there's a lot in the news, and we'll hear more as Howard Schultz takes back over as CEO, but I'm really excited to see what he does. But it was shocking to me to hear that Starbucks spends more money on their people. So their comp bases, their plans, their support, like all the other, there's college and university angles in there for certain positions that you can get support around, but they spend more money on their people than they do on coffee. Which for me is a shocking stat. Great hook line for them to go out into the media and share that, but it's true. And they're backing it up and it's been a long-term play. That stat's not COVID related or pandemic related. They've been sharing that, I think, for the last 5 or 6 years. And what I'm seeing other companies do, like the Joey Restaurant Group, which is in Canada, but also in Seattle, they've got a footprint. And what I love about the Joey Restaurant Group is their how successful they've been in the U.S., and I think for us, there are some West Coast chains that just have an absolute mindset around people development and retention. So what we're seeing now is bad language, but if somebody, how do we have longer term support models? So some people would call it an old language, golden handcuffs. So how are we incentivizing people not only to join the teams, but more importantly to stay? I was working with a client on Friday and we're working on 36-month bonus programs. So there's, in addition to their annual comp, we're looking at bigger incentives that when we achieve it as a company and them inside their roles, will allow them to look through the pandemic with us. I know looking outside of 3 years right now is like a lifetime, but if I had core people on my team or a client I was working with is what can we do to excite them, invest in their development and help them stay with us through their growth for the next 36 months. And if we just focus this conversation for you, and I think it's active for the great restaurant brands, hotel or restaurant operations, it's that mindset is what do I need to do so my core team is with me 36 months from now? If you just wrote that on a piece of paper and drove your next team meeting around that question, I promise you the curiosity and the question, you're going to find out we don't want certain people with us 36 months from now. We're going to outgrow them. Sure, that's an isolated conversation. Mm-hmm. We absolutely, if we could clone these employees, we would because they're so incredible. Let's wrap a plan around them. Let's share it with them for their feedback and let's execute. And that's the last thing I'll say on this topic is people that are creating these plans are doing it with them, not for them. So we create the 70, 80% of the framework, but they are getting their feedback. So it's a well-received retention plan. And I want to use the word retention over comp because it's not just about compensation.
Right.
It's about the culture and engagement and development.
Completely. Best recruiting strategy is a retention strategy. Yes. There's no 100%. Doubt. Yep. Just one last question here. If you were an employee going in to have an interview now with, you know, a restaurant, hotel group, whatever, what are some of the questions that you need to be asking to make sure that the organization is a good fit for you? And it's probably wrapped up in everything that we've talked about for the last 45 minutes is you want to make sure that the organization is thinking about this stuff. How do you find out that they are?
Yeah, I think one question that I'd ask up front is how do I win or succeed in my role? Because I think there's a difference between tactics and so we look at the job posting, right? And there's the 12 bullet points and you need to be friendly and nice and good and, you know, have 3 to 5 years experience, all this classic stuff. But how do I win in my role? How will I be measured for success? And you'll be able to see if they have clarity around it. And don't necessarily judge them if they can't clearly ask the question. It's a big one, and some great operators, some incredible operators I've worked with couldn't answer it. So figure out how do we win in our role? And then the next one I'd ask is what's your path to leadership? So if I'm starting as a supervisor, you know, what's the time frame and what's expected of me along the way? Approximately, no promises are owed to anybody because we don't know the future. But knowing what we've just gone through, what's the time frame for me to go from supervisor to bar manager to AGM to GM? And I actually want your job one day. How long would it take me and what would I need to do to get that? What they'll do if you ask that question, even if you say, what's the path to leadership? They'll be able to see, are they thinking about it? Are they thinking about development of their people? And again, I don't want you to overjudge them because if they have management gaps or leadership gaps right now, they're going to be trying to fill them. But if they can't answer it for you clearly in the interview, I'd ask it a couple of times or through that process, but make sure to keep it in front of them in your one-on-ones or your reviews. Because if you ask the question, they will over time give it attention. But how do we win? And what's the path to leadership? So, and this is when I had somebody ask it, because I want to get your job. Somebody asked me that. And I hired him on the spot.
That's awesome.
Worked with you for like 7 years. He was great.
Love it. Love it. Matt, I appreciate you coming on. This is a great conversation. If anybody wants to learn more about you, what you're up to, or, you know, get the book, where should they go?
If you want to get a copy of You Can't Do It Alone, you can find the copy of the book on Amazon. We're lucky enough to hit 5 bestsellers lists, which we didn't see coming, and the response has been great. We also have an audiobook that'll be launched shortly for free. So if you follow me on LinkedIn at Matt Rolfe, R-O-L-F-E on LinkedIn, we've got with support from Cisco, Cisco Food Service, we'll be launching the book out to the industry at no cost in audio format. And we also have an online course that we're just developing an app platform, which we'll launch soon. It'll launch our Restaurant Leadership Mastery Program at no cost. This was something we charged $1,000 for before. And we have a full integrated app platform. You'll be able to go on, share it with your managers, drive conversation. But now's time for us to give back. The Leadership Mastery Program is a project of ours, and the support from Cisco and the audiobook's been great. And we just want to get more support in operators' hands.
Yeah, perfect. I'll link to everything in the show notes if anybody wants to learn more. So
awesome.
This is great. Matt, thanks again for coming on. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you so much. I love the conversation.
This was my episode with Matt Rolfe. You can learn more about him at mattrolfe.com and be sure to check out his book, You Can't Do It Alone, on Amazon. Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. If you're not a subscriber to the podcast, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For past episodes or to get in touch with us, just go to theprovenprinciplespodcast.com. And if you want to follow us on Instagram, we're at The Proven Principles Podcast, or just find us on LinkedIn. I'm Adam Knight, and you've been listening to The Proven Principles Podcast. Until next time.